some people's mind, it seemed a bit far-fetched that we could actually manipulate beetle behavior on that scale, but it's looking very promising.
A potential treatment for spruce bark beetle deforestation. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 17th of February. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, competitors watch the front runners pull ahead in the Yukon Quest.
And your competitive personality, it's like sitting on your hands and biting your tongue, you know.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. It's never too early to set expectations and goals for your child's education. The UA College Savings Plan provides opportunities that can help you reach your educational savings goals. Save in Alaska, study anywhere. There's more information available by calling 1-888-4, and then Alaska. This message sponsored by the UA College Savings Plan.
On Anchorage's east side, an early morning traffic stop led to a bomb squad call-out and a five-hour street closure. KSKA's Len Anderson has details.
Around 3 o'clock this morning, Anchorage police officer Matt Jensen pulled a vehicle over into the parking lot of the Anchorage School District Administration Building on Boniface Parkway and Northern Lights Boulevard. Shortly afterwards, the stop for vehicle equipment failure, a broken side mirror, suddenly took on a new dimension. Along with the 27-year-old driver was his 24-year-old passenger. According to APD's Lieutenant Dave Cook, a quick computer check showed the passenger was on probation and under felony supervision for a drug offense.
The officer made contact with the on-duty probation parole officer, who requested that the officer conduct a search of the passenger and the vehicle, as that is one of the conditions of his parole. The officer did so. When he was searching the vehicle, he found what appeared to be a pipe bomb between the seats of the vehicle. He also found in the back seat what appeared to be at least two, possibly three additional pipe bombs.
Upon finding the suspicious-looking pieces of pipe, Cook says the officer acted quickly.
The officer secured the occupants, transported them to the police station, called out an explosive ordnance disposal team to handle the apparent pipe bombs.
Because of the potential danger, Northern Lights was shut down between Boniface and Baxter Road. The APD bomb squad took the suspected pipe bombs to an undisclosed area where they were made harmless. After nearly 5 hours, Northern Lights Boulevard was reopened at 8:30 a.m. The two men were taken to the Anchorage Police Department, where FBI and federal alcohol, tobacco, and firearms agents joined the questioning. Authorities have requested a search warrant for the residence of the passenger. As of airtime, the bomb call-out remains under investigation, and no one has been charged with criminal possession of explosives. However, police have charged the passenger, John Pompora, with a probation violation. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
The Justice Department has replaced the lawyers who prosecuted former Senator Ted Stevens with a new team for the post-trial proceedings. The original lawyers have been accused of misconduct by an FBI agent who worked on the case. Whether the agent's allegations have merit is still being investigated. But the Justice Department announced yesterday it's pulling William Welsh, who heads the public integrity section, off the case, along with his deputy Brenda Morris, who was the lead prosecutor during the Stevens trial. Welsh, Morris, and another member of their team were found in contempt on Friday by Judge Emmett Sullivan for not turning over documents to Stevens' lawyers. Four other lawyers have also been taken off the case, including U.S. Assistant Attorney Joe Bottini from the Anchorage office. They're being replaced by the chief of the Justice Department's Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs section, Paul O'Brien, and two others. The post-trial proceedings since Ted Stevens was convicted in October have been messy and riddled with complications. Information about the Justice Department's decision to swap prosecutors came in a filing yesterday. In it, the government also says it will not fight a request by Stevens' lawyers to turn over documents and information. The Justice Department says it wants to avoid distractions and stay focused on the post-trial motions. Ted Stevens' lawyers have filed a slew of motions trying to get his guilty verdict overturned. A hearing has been scheduled for April to go over post-trial discovery matters. No sentencing date has yet been set. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski says it remains unclear just how much money the state will receive from the federal stimulus package. KRBD's Deanna Garrison reports.
President Obama signed the $787 billion stimulus package Tuesday, opening the floodgates of federal spending that Murkowski says is unprecedented. Senator Murkowski voted against the stimulus bill, which she discussed during a visit to Ketchikan on Tuesday.
I think we agreed on the ends, which is we must attempt to stimulate the economy. We disagreed on the means to get there. And what we have as a consequence is an enormous spending package, the likes of which this nation has simply never seen. And we did it in such a hurried rush that I am very fearful of the waste that we will see and the lack of accountability and the lack of transparency.
Murkowski says she would have liked to have seen more money set aside in the bill for transportation projects in particular. She says a state share of the transportation portion of the package will range between $127 and $175 million.
Out of the $838 billion bill, 3% goes towards infrastructure.
She says she believes that much of the money included in the spending package won't actually stimulate the economy.
I am so supportive of what we need to do with education and making sure that we've got the funding there. But tell me how Title I funding and plussing that up for the state, it's about $32 million to us. Tell me how that is creating jobs in this economy.
Murkowski says the federal government is spending more money on the stimulus package than it did in Iraq, on the Vietnam War, or the New Deal. In addition to Ketchikan, Murkowski is visiting Sitka, Juneau, and Anchorage before returning to Washington, D.C. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
Senator Mark Begich held listening sessions with veterans today in Fairbanks and yesterday in Anchorage. His office says about 60 people attended the Anchorage meeting and around 40 showed up in Fairbanks today. The senator's press secretary, Julie Haskett, says topics ranged from health care to concerns about suicide rates of combat veterans and questions about the economic stimulus package. Begich has serving on the Senate Armed Services Committee and the Veterans Affairs Committee and notes that veterans comprise 11% of Alaska's population, more than 70,000 people.
You know, Alaska is very complex when it comes to veterans issues. And you just take health care, delivery of health care in this unique environment of Alaska. You can't just go drive down to the clinic and get dealt with. You have to fly for hundreds of miles. You have to figure out how to ensure that the care is available. And a growing number of veterans that are coming into our state because it is a place that people like to retire.
Begich has signed on to legislation in the Veterans Affairs Committee. One bill would forward fund veterans' health care through the advance appropriations process. Begich says the Veterans Health Care Budget Reform and Transparency Act would provide funding a year in advance.
I really like this concept because forward funding or two-year funding is something we introduced as a mayor of Anchorage. We went to a two-year funding cycle. The reason we did that, because then you could manage the product, the programs, rather than pushing paper every year. So it was very valuable. I think this is a good move. It also creates some stability to the Veterans Administration in the sense of delivering health care and other services to veterans.
Begich is also co-sponsoring a bill to increase disabled veterans' compensation through a cost-of-living adjustment. It has the support of everyone on the Veterans Affairs Committee, Democrats and Republicans alike. Begich has a staff person in Anchorage focused on military and veterans' affairs. C.W. Floyd is a retired 21-year Army Vietnam veteran and worked on vets' issues for Begich in the Anchorage mayor's office. Begich is spending time in Alaska during the week-long congressional recess. On Thursday, he'll go to Bethel, where he'll tour the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation facilities with Darren Peet, the Bureau of Indian Affairs Congressional Director. From there, he plans to talk over video conference with people in Emonic, St. Mary's, Tuksuk Bay, and Aniak. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an expedition to measure the Arctic sea ice.
The journey is going to involve a 1,000-kilometer trek, pulling sledges up to almost twice our body weights. I don't know why I'm smiling, because it sounds horrendous to me.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
BP, giving back to the community is a priority because so many at BP call Alaska home. The University of Alaska Fairbanks now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
A substance found in herbal tea could help prevent the type of beetle infestation that has devastated forests in the West, including Alaska. A recent study from the U.S. Forest Service shows an aerial application of a pheromone was effective in keeping beetles off of trees in California and Idaho. Scientists have known for a decade that the pheromone works, but have had trouble identifying an effective way to distribute it. The study found sprinkling flakes from helicopters was an effective method. Nancy Gillette is a research entomologist with the U.S. Forest Service in California who worked on the study. She says the pheromone is a naturally occurring substance.
Methylcyclohexanone, which we call MCH for short, for good reason, is essentially a cue to spruce beetles that the host tree is already occupied by members of its own species. And most of these tree-killing aggressive bark beetles, they have to aggregate in large numbers on a tree in order to kill it. They have to mass attack in order for their progeny to survive. So they have pheromones that a different pheromone that cause them to aggregate on the trees. But once they've fully colonized that tree, they need to know when to stop. Otherwise, their larvae, their progeny, will be overcrowded in that tree.
Interesting. So it's not something that necessarily they just don't like the smell of. It's something that tells them this house is already full and you'll have to move on.
Precisely. Yes. Yes. It's we call it a no vacancy signal or a go find another tree signal. It's really the insect's way of partitioning the resource, the host tree.
And this compound has a rather imposing name, but it's my understanding that it's a naturally occurring compound. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. It's produced by beetles naturally. Its precursors are produced by pine trees. It has kind of a piney smell, and it's used in food products, beverages, perfumes, things like that.
And how did you discover that this would work?
For quite a number of years now, the Forest Service has been using the same little flakes to release a moth pheromone to control gypsy moth. And we have a program called Slow the Spread where the moth pheromone is released in these little flakes, and it prevents the male moths from being able to find the female moths. So by extrapolation, what I wanted to do with this beetle pheromone, which is structurally a bit different, is to prevent the beetles from finding a host tree. And so it was just a matter of working with the pheromone industry to get them to formulate it in a form that could be dispersed, and conducting a lot of large-scale testing just to see if it would work. It's in some people's mind, it seemed a bit far-fetched that we could actually manipulate beetle behavior on that scale, but it's looking very promising.
Does this research hold promise for Alaska and our spruce bark beetle problem here?
I think it's certainly possible. The insect species that I've been working with are ones that are more southerly in distribution, but there's certainly a lot of interest among Canadian and American entomologists in testing a product like this for spruce beetle control. Now, it may need additional active ingredients. It may be that methylcyclohexanone is not enough for the spruce beetle. There may be additional components that we need to add in order to have the same kind of efficacy. But it's certainly promising, and people are planning to work on that.
Nancy Gillette is an entomologist with the U.S. Forest Service. A research team is skiing to the top of the world to measure Arctic sea ice. Estimates suggest the Arctic's total volume of sea ice has dropped by 80% in 20 years. But that is based on data from submarines and satellites. This expedition will take measurements from the surface. The CBC's Peter Sheldon reports.
Arctic explorer Penn Haddo sums up his next 3 months.
The journey is going to involve a 1,000-kilometer trek, pulling sledges up to almost twice our body weights in temperatures that in the early stages may be up to 5 times colder than the normal domestic deep freeze. Don't know why I'm smiling, because it sounds horrendous to me.
He says his trekking skills are usually socially irrelevant and bizarre. Now he has a reason to use them.
When I became aware about 5 years ago that there was this sort of missing data set of actual and accurate measurements taken at the surface, it occurred to me that that was, you know, we could contribute to science in this sort of in this way.
Joining Haddo are explorer Ann Daniels and photographer Martin Hartley. It's taken 5 years to plan the expedition, and sponsors have already spent over $5 million. Using radar technology, the group will take a picture every few seconds all the way from the Arctic coast to the pole. Up to 10 times a day, they'll use a 5-meter drill to measure the thickness of the ice. If they encounter patches of water, they swim. If the radar breaks...
We have a spare.
Arctic scientists around the globe will get to share the data. Throughout the trip, everything from raw ice measurements to the explorers' heart rates will be posted online. Look for a drop in those heart rates early this summer. The three explorers are due at the North Pole in May. Peter Sheldon, Yellowknife.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
Work began today in Juneau on a bill that would give the state the legal ability to assist in humanitarian needs that fall short of qualifying as a state or federal disaster. The need for such aid comes from the conditions this winter in rural Alaska, where residents, already hit hard by low incomes, face record-high fuel prices along with expensive food. Food was collected across the state, but supporters face the problem of delivering the donations. The measure by Fairbanks Republican Jay Ramris originally would have given the governor the ability to dedicate state transportation equipment to nonprofit and faith-based groups responding to a disaster. However, he told the House Transportation Committee that his true goal was to create a definition falling between a full-scale disaster response and doing nothing.
Nonprofits and individuals from across the state and country have come forward to assist these 11 western communities. And unfortunately, because of the cost of transportation, it has been exceedingly difficult to figure out a mechanism to deliver the goodwill of Alaskans.
A disaster declaration opens state and federal resources for relief purposes, and for that, strict state and federal requirements must be met. Military and Veterans Affairs spokesman McHugh Pierre says the new category would still would not permit the use of National Guard and Air National Guard assets, since those are controlled by federal regulations. Anchorage Republican Craig Johnson, however, challenged that presumption.
Can you please explain to me how we fly Santa Claus around the state?
We are a federally sanctioned mission through DOD, the Pentagon. We provide a goodwill mission to villages that are in need, and we also use that as a recruiting tool, and it's justified through different opportunities there.
I have a problem with it being elevated above hunger.
The bill was given to a subcommittee to determine an intermediate level of emergency and what assets and equipment would be made available. The Department of Law and the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs were also tasked with developing a procedure for using federal equipment in such an emergency. The bill is not scheduled for another hearing, pending the work by the subcommittee. A House bill changing cruise ship wastewater discharge rules is on the fast track. The measure moved out of its first committee this morning. It has just one more panel to clear before heading to the House floor. The bill was introduced Friday by former House Speaker John Harris, a Valdez Republican. It would remove strict water quality standards set by the Cruise Ship Initiative passed by voters in 2006. It would give that authority to the State Department of Environmental Conservation. Ketchikan City Mayor Bob Weinstein testified in favor of the bill at today's Community and Regional Affairs Committee hearing.
The application of the standard imposed by initiative in the absence of practical and readily available technology will result in cruise vessels traveling outside state waters for discharge in federal waters. This will result in either less visits or shorter visits to port communities like Ketchikan, with adverse economic impacts upon us.
The bill has well-organized support. Representatives of Alaska's Chamber of Commerce, Municipal League, and Tourism Industry Association also spoke in favor, and 10 House members, including several leaders, have signed up as co-sponsors. Opponents include backers of the initiative that put the limits in law. Juneau's Kirk Hardcastle told the committee Southeast fisheries need strong protection.
For me, as a commercial fisherman, it's not the concentration. It's the volume. We're talking about a volume of discharge. That's 1 million people, possibly twice a day discharge, in Southeast Alaskan waters. That's more than the whole state of Alaska discharging in Southeast Alaskan waters.
About 1 million passengers cruise through Alaska waters every year. The bill would lessen discharge rules by allowing mixing zones, which dilute hazardous materials. Cruise lines say they cannot meet new standards for ammonia, copper, nickel, and zinc that take effect in 2010. They want state scientists, not initiative writers, to set those standards. Opponents of the legislation say the lines can meet the standards, in part by changing plumbing and water use practices. They also want more information about new research on pollution control equipment. State Water Division Director Lynn Kent has reviewed that research, which is being discussed at a conference this week.
We are not currently aware of treatment systems that are readily available to be installed on all vessels by the 2010 season that would produce effluent meeting water quality standards without the use of mixing zones. There are certainly shore-based types of treatment technologies that can do that, but they haven't been applied to vessels at this point in time.
The bill moved out of the committee on a 5-2 vote. The next stop is House Resources. Quest frontrunners are on the final 100 miles of trail heading into the race's halfway point at Dawson City. John Little left the Scroggy Creek dog drop first at 4 this morning and was followed by Sebastian Schnula, William Cleeden, and Hugh Neff over the next 5 hours. Michelle Phillips, Hans Gott, Brent Sass, Warren Palfrey, and Martin Boozer are also out of Scroggy Creek. The first team is expected to reach Dawson City tonight and claim the halfway prize, 4 ounces of gold. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, mushers chasing the front group are still holding out hope for the rest of the race.
Mushers generally follow run and rest schedules set out before the race with a few mid-course alterations. Changes that reflect their dog's health, the weather, the trail, and even though most won't admit it, what other racers are doing. Mushers test their competitors to see if they can keep up or try to chase those getting too far ahead. The father of top 10 musher Brent Sass says his son trains his team specifically for the kind of tight racing going on at the front of this year's Quest.
It isn't about just pulling something out of the hat. It's about, did you train properly and know what your limits are of your dogs?
Mark Sass says Brent used this year's Copper Basin 300 race to test his team's ability to pull off a very long run in a race situation.
To confirm the stamina that he really felt he had with them. And he went over 100 miles and 20 hours.
Mark Sass says if the dog's fitness is there, Brent may try to pull ahead with a long run into Dawson. Most top mushers are likely capable of such a feat, but Michelle Phillips, who's also running near the front of this year's race, says the strategy only works as an exception, not a day-in, day-out philosophy. She says she prefers staying with the standard equal run rest approach, but she admits it's hard not to try to catch up all at once.
When you're competitive personality, it's hard to do. It's like sitting on your hands and biting your tongue, you know.
Phillips says it's tempting to overly push dogs when approaching Dawson City because of the 36-hour break mushers have to take there, but she says overdoing it can doom the second half of the race.
I mean, just think of yourself as a runner. You get down so low, you're not going to pop back up or have any speed again.
Phillips had dropped three dogs as of Pelly Crossing, but is running in the top 10 with what she describes as a happy team with good leaders. There are a couple of mushers conspicuously absent from the top 10 right now. Last year's third-place finisher and the most experienced Quest racer in the field, Dave Dalton, has been struggling. Dalton says he slowed down when he had to carry some injured dogs in his sled, but that his team is back on track and believes he'll reel in those pushing the pace at the front.
That's what I've seen in the past. That's where I usually catch people is in the second half because they've slowed way down, cutting rest in the first half.
Dalton says it'll likely take him the entire race to claw back the 6 to 8 hours he's fallen behind. Other mushers also remain optimistic that the more conservative way they're running will pay off later in the race. Dan Caduce says he's been banking rest.
I've actually rested the dogs 3 hours more than I've run to this point, which is, you know, quite a bit different from the front of the pack. So we'll see how that equates to second half speed.
Caduce, who's been running in the top 20, says not everybody ahead of him will be able to maintain the pace.
A few of them will hold it, for sure, but a few of them won't.
That belief is keeping the spirits of mushers who've fallen even further behind alive. Near the back of the pack, Jason Mackey says he's holding out hope.
I'm not worried. I mean, there's a long way to go. In a day or two, I'll see these teams.
The brother of the race's four-time champion still has high aspirations despite tanking in the first 2 days of racing. He'd fallen back to 27th place as of yesterday. Mackey says his team excels at climbing and that it'll be moving up as the trail winds through the Black Hills and over King Solomon's Dome on the way to Dawson. Reporting on the Yukon Quest Trail in Pelly Crossing, I'm Dan Bross.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, Len Anderson in Anchorage, Peter Sheldon in Yellowknife, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Dan Bross on the Yukon Quest Trail. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. Duncan Moon is our vice president for media production. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and by BP, teaming up with Alaskans since statehood and together looking toward a bright future. It's never too early to set expectations and goals for your child's education. The UA College Savings Plan provides opportunities that can help you reach your educational savings goals. Save in Alaska, study anywhere. There's more information available by calling 1-888-4 and then Alaska. This message sponsored by the UA College Savings Plan.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.